Hi, I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Room for Innocence.
I am so excited to go over this case with you. And we did something different this week. Instead of us both researching, I'm surprising you with the case that we're talking about, which obviously means, as my legal expert, you're coming in just totally blind.
Yeah. No idea what's going on.
Okay. Have you ever heard of Jodi Arias?
Oh, the name is very familiar. I feel like I should know who this person is.
Well, that's why I'm excited to tell you about it, because I was hoping you did not know about it. Okay. Jodi Arias.
Sounds like a girl. It's a guy, isn't it?
It is a girl. My source material here is a website called murderpedia.org.
Ooh, okay. All right.
And murderpedia.org has... It has the crime scene photos and autopsy photos.
Okay.
I mean, I kind of regret having looked at them. But not really. At the same time, I'm like, that was really interesting. But it's just like, oh God. Ugh. There's court documents. There's all kind of neat stuff on Murderpedia.
I like that.
All right. And then the other material for this case came from a show that I access on Peacock. And the show is called Snapped.
I've seen Snapped. It's usually about women who have killed their men, right?
It's about women who have killed someone. I think it's been a man in everyone that I've seen. Yeah. They have a two-parter on Jodi Arias, and it's really good. So here's the story. Are you ready?
I'm dying to hear this.
In early June 2008, Travis Alexander was on top of the world. Recently single, he'd thrown himself into his work at Prepaid Legal Services, where he was a top sales executive.
Was he an attorney?
No. So Prepaid Legal Services, have you ever heard of multi-level marketing? It's the idea that you sell whatever product you have, and then you kind of like hire other people to sell, and then you get a portion of what they sell, right?
Right.
So Prepaid Legal Services was a company that sold, it was kind of like legal insurance. Like you could pay a monthly fee, and then if you needed legal services, they were prepaid. You know, you could access legal services. All right. So he was a top sales executive. He'd been invited on a work trip to Cancun and had invited his new girlfriend, Mimi Hall, to join him. June 2008, Travis was looking forward to a fun, relaxing summer. On June 4th, Travis missed a conference call for work, which was highly unusual. And then on June 9th, the day before Travis and Mimi were scheduled to leave for Cancun, Mimi was concerned. She hadn't heard from Travis in days and was unable to reach him.
So Travis is not acting according to his regular patterns.
Exactly. Going on, right? And, you know, they were supposed to leave for this trip the next day, and Mimi's getting concerned. She's calling him. He's not calling back. She's leaving messages on his phone. He's not calling back.
There's going to be a flurry of extra activity going on between, I would think, normal people. We're going to Cancun.
This is what you need. This is what you need to pack. Here's the agenda.
All this preparation, crazy stuff. They're going to be like, bah, 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 back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
And she's asking him for that stuff, and he's not providing it. So she reaches out to his friends and she's like, hey, I'm not hearing back from him. Have you guys heard from him? And they're all like, shoot, no, I haven't heard from him in a few days. So now everyone's concerned. They all knew they kind of weren't hearing back from him, assumed he was busy, but he had missed this call at work And then he wasn't reaching out to Mimi, who he was supposed to go on a trip with. So they knew this was serious.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
So Travis's friends and Mimi go over to Travis's house. Now, I mentioned that he was pretty successful. He had a 4,000 square foot house.
That's a lot of house.
In Mesa, Arizona, that he owned.
Man, that sounds beautiful. Like, ooh, I bet it's nice.
Drove a Beamer. You know, I mean, he was living large. And he had a couple of roommates. And his roommate was home. And his roommate said, no, he's not here. He's in Cancun.
What's his roommate's name?
I don't know. It's not Jody Arias.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. That's what I... All right. Go on.
Yeah.
So he's not here.
So the roommate says he's not here. He's in Cancun. And Mimi is like, no, he's not. We're supposed to leave for Cancun tomorrow. So the roommate invited them in. And right away, okay, the friends, they could tell there was a bit of a smell.
Like a rotten meat smell?
Like the house didn't smell very good.
Well, I mean, like my house, I'm a single guy. You come in here. I got a dog. I got the cat. I've got two kids.
Oh yeah, blame the kids.
So anyway, so they go in, the house smells
right funny, away. They're right? Like, the house smells funky. What's going on? The roommate is like, you know, I don't know if they discussed it at the time, but later the roommate said, yeah, he had noticed the smell, but he figured it was trash or food or something. Now it's 4,000 square foot house, right? And Travis has this huge owner's suite upstairs. It has a long hallway that leads down to it and everything. So he's got his own part of the house. They start walking up to his room and they open the door to his suite and the smell hits them in the face.
You know that smell, right? I mean, you.
I have seen an autopsy. I know the smell of dead body. Yeah.
You know, I've never been in an autopsy, I don't think, but just like rotten smell, like an autopsy, I would think that does it smell the same as like when it's rotting in a room unrefrigerated?
It's such a bad smell. There are no words. They give you the Vicks vapor rub to put under your nose.
I love the movies where like the coroner's like eating a sandwich while he's showing you like the liver.
Totally. Yeah. So
I couldn't do it. Maybe when I was younger, I think I could have, but
if I cook like fish and then I throw all the trash in the trash can, a day or two later, you know, you pop open the trash can to throw something in and you're just smacked in the face with that. Yeah. So that's what Travis's room smelled like.
But anyway, so they open the door, it stinks
just awful. There's a large pool of blood. There's a blood trail leading into the bathroom. The sheets have been removed from the bed. So the friends follow the blood trail into the bathroom. They go inside and find his dead body crumpled in his small shower. He had a big bathroom with a bathtub. And then next to it, he had one of those small showers, you know, and he's like crumpled at the bottom of the shower. And there was blood all over the bathroom, on the sink, the floor, the walls. It was obvious he had been murdered and it had happened at least a few days ago.
What happened next? What did the people do? Because like right away, I would have been running out to the roommate, been like, what the fuck, dude?
Okay.
You know, like.
They call 911.
Yeah.
And then the first thing the 911 operator says is, get out of the house. Everybody out of the house now. So everybody piles out of the house. There's about five of them, including the roommate. And Mimi Hall is on the phone with the 911 operator. And the 911 operator says, has he been threatened by anyone recently? And she says, yes, he has. He has an ex-girlfriend that's been bothering him, following him, slashing tires, things like that. And the operator says, and do you know the ex-girlfriend's name? And Mimi says, you know, to her friends, what is her name? What is the girlfriend's name? Her name is Jody. The operator says, has he ever reported her to the police? Okay, just a second. Has he ever reported her? No, he hasn't reported anything about Jody's behavior. And there we are. Okay, who's Jody? Jody Arias had been born in 1980 and grew up in Salinas, California. So she's 28 at this time.
Okay.
She dropped out of high school when she was 17. And the following years were spent with a string of boyfriends throughout Southern California, waitressing and trying to make a living doing photography. In 2006, Jody got a job in sales with prepaid legal services. In September of 2006, at a prepaid legal services conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, Jody met Travis Alexander.
He was the top dog.
Yeah, he was a big deal.
Oh, he was a stud. They were running after him. She got his attention.
Travis had an executive sales position with the company, and as a high performer, he was invited to speak at these company events, as well as to attend VIP banquets and special trips. Travis was immediately attracted to Jody. He found her beautiful, talented, and charismatic.
Ah.
Okay. And Jody was new to prepaid legal services, so she was thrilled when Travis yeah. invited her to attend a VIP banquet that evening.
That seems totally appropriate.
And the pictures of this, she's an attractive girl.
Oh, he feeds on all the new ones, I'm sure.
And she's definitely like thin and athletic. Like she's kind of a babe. And she's got dyed blonde hair. And I can definitely see that a guy who's, you know, looking for a hot chick would be interested in Jody.
Okay.
Travis, you know, good looking guy. He's got on this at this banquet, like a pinstripe suit. It's like black with kind of wide white stripes, thin stripes, but like
gangster far stripes. Apart.
Yes, it is yeah. totally a it's gangster
like
suit.
Al Capone.
It's yeah, it's really something. So they go to this banquet, and then Travis and Jody stay up late into the evening talking, apparently until about 4 o'clock in the morning.
They had a connection.
Now, by the way, Jody had a boyfriend that she had been with for about 4 years that she lived with. So she had a serious relationship already.
Well, I'm sure this was just platonic, just a platonic evening.
But they were just making a connection. It was business, all business.
Yeah.
Travis was Mormon, and he talked to Jody about his religion. Have you ever known anybody who was Mormon?
I think I might have maybe known one, but I didn't really know the person. And I mean, I've heard all sorts of stuff, but not really.
So he starts talking about being Mormon. And one of the key tenets of Mormonism is abstinence outside of marriage. No sex outside of marriage.
Isn't that like what's different between that and the Catholic Church? Other than the fact that Catholics don't care and they do it anyway, but we're not supposed to.
I don't really know what's different, but apparently it's very serious. And if you are a young adult Mormon, your whole network of friends takes this very seriously. They talk about it a lot. So it's not one of those things where, you know, we all do it on the sly and just pretend not to. Like they really take it very seriously. Mormonism also promotes children and families and healthy living. Jody's current boyfriend that she lived with had a child from a previous marriage, and he'd made it clear that he didn't want any more children. And Jody was 28. She was, you know, hoping to build a family. So she was intrigued by Travis and she was intrigued by Mormonism. And after returning home from Vegas, she broke it off with her boyfriend and began a long distance relationship with Travis.
Now that's difficult.
But it's California to Arizona, so they're able to see each other. It's just a long drive. She lives in California. Travis lives in the Phoenix suburb of Mesa, Arizona. Things between Jody and Travis progress quickly. First off, Travis is not going to have a relationship with somebody that isn't Mormon. They met in September of 2006 at the conference in Las Vegas. In November, Jody gets baptized into the Mormon church.
That's
intense.
That's intense. That there's a lot that could be said about that. One, maybe the person has absolutely just gives zero fucks about their religion and they're like, whatever. But even so, even if you are a zero on the meter of religious concern, that you would jump through the hoops to now have yourself stamped as such to live that kind of lifestyle is pretty intense. And if you do believe in religion, to jump from one to the other, that's very, that isn't there. That is intense. Absolutely. Yeah.
But at any rate, she gets baptized.
You know, let me say this too. I'm sorry. Like what's interesting about this to me is just like, and I love that. I have no idea what's going to happen here, but there's red lights all over the place just with what's going on with their relationship. It's like, so the question could be, is he a manipulator? Is he strong arming her into doing this? Or, and some of these questions might be answered if you know, we actually knew these people, or maybe you can answer them, but is he strong arming her into doing this? Or is she like freeload, you know, not freeloading. That's not the right word. Is she just like, this is great. Like jumping on this guy's coattails and climbing all the way up as quick as she can. Or is she just in love? You know what I mean? Cause there's also that sometimes you're just like, man, I'm in love. Well, all right, fine. I'll be a Mormon. Your 4,000 square foot house, no matter how wonderful any or meant to be or correct or well-formed something is, you don't really understand it. The layers, it takes a lot more than a couple of months to really even understand how you feel about things. That's why relationships change over the course and grow and et cetera over the course of years and years and years. So there's a lot of crazy going on here. These people are nuts so far.
Yeah. I mean, so she's getting baptized into an entirely new religion. Like you said, is she just madly in love with him? Is she using him? Is she desperate for him? You know, like she needs him somehow? Is he using her? Like, I don't know. But she is now a Mormon. And by the way, Travis was an elder in the Mormon church. So he actually baptized her.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I've just been in the criminal justice system too long. You know, this whole thing ends up making me nervous.
Tom?
Yeah.
You're right to be concerned.
I get the feeling something happens at some point.
Spoiler alert. Okay. So I did make a note here that I do think Jody's conversion to Mormonism reflects a desire to belong, to be accepted, and to have purpose. So since she dropped out of school, she's been following boyfriends around. And again, she's been living with this man for the last 4 years who didn't want to have children. And I think she saw in Travis somebody who, you know, wanted a family, seemed really into her. And I think it's just like people who get kind of pulled into a cult. I'm not saying Mormonism's a cult, but there are people that need that. They need to belong to this group.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
So as I mentioned, the Mormon church prohibits sex before marriage. It's something that Mormons take very seriously. And obviously Jody is not a virgin. She's been living with this man for 4 years.
Well, he's used to these nice Mormon girls who aren't like her. So if she starts coming at him, this guy's going to be helpless. Oh my God.
Some of what we find out about their sexual relationship really makes me wonder, did she really introduce him to all that? You know, so we'll talk okay, a little bit more about that. But anyway, I think that this is me speculating, but I think she was a bit broken. And that Travis and Mormonism provided an opportunity for her to feel wholesome and good.
And that's what it's all about. So sure, that should be a wonderful thing that results in healing. So let's see what happens.
Now, all this being said, Jody says that their sexual relationship began a week after they met. So they met in Vegas. They go back home to their separate, you know, she goes home to California. He goes back to Arizona. And Travis had a friend, some friends that were a married couple that lived midway between him and Jody. And these friends said, hey, if you want to meet up with her, you can meet at our house. We have a bedroom for each of you. So Travis and Jody would go to this house. And according to Jody, the relationship was immediately sexual, and not just sexual, but kinky sexual, all different kind, everything, bondage, pictures and video, like the works.
My thought is that this guy was not a virgin, obviously, going into it. And the reason I say that is because something like 28-year-old, 30-year-old virgin, silly to even think about that. It doesn't even make sense. So let's say that this guy was able to do that, be just a player and fight it all off. And it just, Anyway, I'm just saying, like, people move into things slowly, like when you're first starting out.
And, right. So he held out for 30 years and then he immediately caves with her.
It's just such a dated concept. It doesn't make any kind of sense. And
well, like, it's religion. It's religion. So you can't really, you know, try to rationalize it.
Absolutely.
But I agree. There's zero chance that this guy was inexperienced. He was kind of a stud, right? So if he wanted to get married and have a family, if he were not getting action, he would have made that happen already. He would have already settled down. And I'm speculating. I don't know him. Who knows? But I feel like a 30-year-old guy, you know, who's a handsome, successful guy, if that's what he wanted, if he wanted to marry a Mormon girl and settle down, he would have done it already.
Okay, so what happens next in here in the story? So where are we? I forget where we even were.
She says, you know, a week into this relationship, they're sexual. And I mean, you know, the way she tells the story,
they're doing it.
He's in it 100% from day one.
All right.
But of course, in order for her to be his official girlfriend, she needs to be Mormon. So if she's not Mormon, she's going to be, you know, a secret side sauce. So she converts to Mormonism and they date officially for about 5 months. Throughout their relationship, he's in Mesa, she's in California. They meet up at the friend's house and, you know, do it like rabbits.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah. In June of 2007, Jody and Travis broke up. They met in September 2006. In June of 2007, they break up. But they continue to see each other for sex. And there's a lot of evidence of this. There's texts. She recorded phone calls. Now, this is what I love. They break up. She now moves to Mesa, Arizona, where he lives. I mean, I guess it's like, it's just so weird. Like, she didn't move while they were dating and she has no job except prepaid legal services and waitressing. So she could have moved to Mesa, but as soon as they break up, she relocates to Mesa. While they were together, she had all kinds of concerning behavior. She would snoop through his phone.
Yeah. People do that all the time.
She would read his emails. And if she saw emails from a woman, she would forward it to her own email account.
That's not good.
She would follow him around to hear conversations that he was having. So if he left the room to talk on the phone, for example, she'd follow him so that she could hear.
I think that behavior is unhealthy for sure.
That's safe. Yeah.
But I think that it happens quite a bit. The thousands of relationships I've been involved with criminal stuff and whatnot, I feel like that, and just stories I hear people talking about, I think that kind of thing happens, sneaking through the phones and all that. I was listening to some people the other day talk about it, about sneaking shit. And I look at his text and I can tell things have been deleted. And I'm just like, why are you looking through them? Why is he deleting stuff? And just whatever.
So the woman who had the house that they would meet up at, her name was Skye. And so Skye told a story. She said, we thought Jody was dangerous. We were really concerned about her behavior. And so when Jody and Travis were at Skye's house, she pulled Travis aside and actually Skye and her husband pulled Travis aside and said, we really need to talk to you. They went into another room and they said, look, we're really worried about Jody. We think that she's snooping through your phone. She's reading your emails. We're really worried that something bad is going to happen. And we just really think that you need to find someone else. And while they're talking to Travis, Skye's like, shh, I think she's outside the door.
See, my mouth was already kind of dropping as you were telling me this stuff. And okay, so
they walk over to the door. Skye's husband walks over to the door and throws the door open and she's standing there.
That's fucking crazy, man. No, bye-bye. Bye-bye. it's just not healthy. If you're doing that in a relationship, he's either cheating on you or he's not. Okay. Either way, you're just not ready for a relationship, because if he is cheating on you,
then leave him.
Leave him. If he's not cheating on you, why do you think he is? Anybody out there who's listening, who is searching through your man or your woman's phone, you need to really sit back and check the direction of your life, you know, for sure. Hopefully nobody's going to die, but like, that's not the way it should be, you know? And like, I envision myself with somebody who, like, I would never want to look through their phone.
Yeah. People say like, this is a relationship that's going to end on Dateline. So that was super creepy when Jody was waiting outside the door while they were talking. And then Skye even said later on in a different conversation, she said to Travis, "I'm afraid we're going to find you chopped up in her freezer." Skye says Jody had crazy eyes. And we just thought she would stop at nothing. Okay, so they break up. She moves to Mesa. She moves nearby him and just kind of won't leave him alone.
No, those are signals. That's bad.
Allegedly, she snuck into his house through his dog door.
Without his permission?
Without his permission, while he was asleep, snuck into his house through the dog door. He came downstairs one morning and she was hiding behind the Christmas tree. And she like jumps out, you know, surprise. Yeah. So he gets a new girlfriend. And while the girlfriend is at his house, you know, snuggling up to a movie, because that's all they do, somebody slashes the girlfriend's tires.
It could be anybody.
So that was June 2007 when she moved down to Mesa. In April 2008, Jody moves back to California to live with her grandparents in a town called Yreka, which is in the far north of California, almost to the Oregon border. So this is far away from Mesa, Arizona. This is like a 15-hour drive. 2 months later, in June 2008, Travis's friends discover his dead body in his shower at home. Travis had been stabbed 27 times.
Say that number again.
27.
27. The first thing that the prosecutors are going to say is that's emotion and that's rage.
That's a crime of passion, right?
Absolutely. That's because it takes a lot of energy and fury and hate. No, they're ham. I can hear them right now.
He was stabbed from behind. He was shot in the forehead.
Oh, that's.
And his throat had been slit from ear to ear so severely that he was nearly decapitated. And have I mentioned I looked at the crime scene photos? It's bad.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
It's bad. And so, you know, he'd been shot in the forehead. The shell casing was laying on top of all of the blood, leading investigators to conclude that the gunshot was the last wound to occur.
Sure. That makes sense.
There's a lot of evidence to support that he was stabbed prior to being shot. Investigators found long, dark hairs. They found a bloody handprint on the wall.
Wow.
And they found a waterlogged digital camera in the washing machine.
Okay.
The memory card was intact, and they were able to see the photos, which didn't show anything interesting. However, there were deleted photos. So the digital camera, someone had deleted photos off the memory card, and they were not able to access those deleted photos. So the memory card was sent to forensic specialists to try to retrieve whatever photos had been deleted.
Okay. Did they get the photos?
You'll find out.
Okay. I mean, it's pointing more and more toward a crime of passion. Just so sloppy. Bloody fingerprints on the wall, or bloody handprint. I'm sure there were prints on there.
But it's so weird. Wait until, like, it just gets weirder.
I'm not saying it's pointing toward her. I'm just saying this is pointing towards something that was done very, very clearly sloppy.
Okay, fair. But she killed him, like, three different ways. You know?
She was like, you're dead. Oh, not yet.
Investigators, you know, they were told immediately on the 911 call that Jody Arias is who the friends think might have done this. Did anybody have it out for Travis? Yeah, Jody Arias. So they're on to her immediately, checking out what's going on with her. But they're busy collecting evidence and questioning witnesses and whatnot. And they're planning to reach out to her. She beats them to it. She calls the police and says, "Hi, this is Jody. I was just wondering, I heard that Travis passed away and I wanted to offer any help that I could provide in finding out what happened. And did you find a weapon?" And
did I leave my gun there?
And the cop is like, "I'm sorry, we can't release that information to you, but we would love to chat." So she agrees to talk to them. And her story is she has not seen Travis since she left Mesa in April to move up to Yreka. And they ask her, you know, "We believe that you saw him on June." They think he died around June 5th. "We believe, you know, that you were there around June 5th and that you saw him." "Nope, absolutely not. I was nowhere near Mesa. Have not seen him since April. You know, we think you were in this toxic relationship." No, "we were physical sometimes, but we were just friends," and all this kind of stuff. They are not buying anything that she's saying.
Now, is this on the phone or is she meeting with him? Because she's hours away, right? Supposedly.
I think this was in person. I really wish I could tell you if the first conversation where she talked about not having been anywhere near him, I can't remember if that one was on the phone or in person.
God, why the fuck would you call the cops? How would she have possibly known? And maybe you said this already, but how long after the murder did she call the cops?
A few days. Oh, that's right. She says, "I'm going to be down there for his funeral and I'll come in and meet with you." And that's what she does. She goes down for his funeral and then she goes in and meets with the cops. And they have this conversation where she says, "I have not been down here since April when I moved up to Yreka." So the cops say, you know, "Okay, thanks for everything." And off she goes. Meanwhile, DNA comes back on the hair. It's a match. The long, dark hairs. It's a match to Jody. Oh, I neglected to mention she had been blonde for the last several years, and she has dark hair now. Since she moved to Yreka. So yeah, she says, "I've spent time there all the time, you know, before I moved." Well, yeah, she was blonde when she moved.
Oh my God.
And they have these dark hairs and they match her DNA. And
now she's a liar. Now they can do anything with whichever she says. She's a liar now.
Then they match her DNA to blood from the scene. There was more than one blood sample, and some of it was hers.
Wow, that's tough.
But the best part of all is when the forensic investigators find the deleted photos.
Oh, they were able to fish the deleted photos out.
They were able to recover the deleted photos.
And what was it? Point of view pictures of her slicing his throat, stabbing him, one last shot to the head.
Practically.
Tell me. Did you see the photos on murderpedia.org?
All the photos are available. Yep.
Okay. Oh, they, tell me.
They photos took of them photos of themselves having sex. All kinds of post-coital photos. You know, she took photos of him. He took photos of her lying there.
It was a lovely evening.
She's got her hair in two long dark braids, you know, like she's trying to look like a little schoolgirl. Graphic sexual photos. Then there's a few photos of him in the shower. And he's kind of like giving the camera a look, you know, like, "Look at me under the water, you know."
Yeah.
Then there's a photo of like the ceiling, almost like the camera got jostled or something.
Oh no.
And then there's a photo with blood.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's like Hangover. We're like, what happened? I don't know. Let's look through the photos.
So investigators are just like, this is a gold mine.
So you know? Walked into the shower and killed that photo of him looking over all sexy or whatever was literally maybe seconds before he died.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, his head's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. That is so creepy.
So the police call her back in and they're like, are you sure that you haven't seen him since April? No, no, officer. No, definitely have not seen him since April. And they're like, well, that's just so weird because we have these pictures that were found on a camera that was in his washing machine. And I mean, her face is just like,
just didn't see it coming. Deleted those photos.
They go to get the photos. And she's in the interrogation room singing to herself, all in this like little angelic kind of choir voice. And then she gets up and does some headstands up against the wall.
I swear, I feel like I've seen
headstands. You've probably seen the woman doing the headstands when the detective left the room.
What the fuck? Just to show I feel totally normal. I'm just gonna sing.
I'm just meditating. I'm
going to do some headstands now in the interrogation room.
Comes back and he gives her the pictures. And I mean, this girl, she is cool as a cucumber. She's like, wow, that does look like me. It's literally her. I mean, it's her. And she actually has them almost questioning, could it possibly not be her? Because she's so good at just being like, huh, that's weird. So she says a bunch of things about, you know, the timestamp must be wrong and all that. And they're like, yeah, except for the fact that these pictures show him being killed 3 hours after the sex pictures were taken. So... mm-hmm. Don't think you can blame the timestamp. I mean, this woman is so caught. So anyway, on July 9th, 2008, a grand jury indicts her on first degree murder.
Oh, wow. Surprise.
And she's extradited to Arizona and a public defender is assigned to represent her. And then a second public defender is assigned that has death penalty, that can defend death penalty case, because Arizona says they're going to pursue the death penalty.
You just have to be qualified as a, you know, not anybody can just jump up and do a death penalty case. You have to have certain experience, and I'm sure every jurisdiction is different. You have maybe whatever you have to do, this, at least one of those attorneys hasn't done it yet. So,
yeah. So she gets indicted on first degree murder and then they arrest her. And after being arrested, she says, all right, I got to come clean. I was down there on June 4th or 5th, June 4th. I lied. I was there. Those pictures are of me. I went down there. Travis and I just had a great day, you know, just rocking and rolling all day, taking all these pictures, good times. And then he wanted to take these shower pictures because he was feeling hot. So I took some pictures of him in the shower because, you know, she's an aspiring photographer. So I took these pictures of him in the shower. And then two masked intruders burst into the room and attacked Travis and shot him. They had a gun and they had a knife. And they let me go. And they said, if I said anything, they would kill my family. I just drove up to Utah to see my boyfriend. She has another boyfriend now. This guy, Burns, Ryan Burns. Yeah, Ryan Burns. She has a new boyfriend, Ryan Burns. She left Travis's that day and drove straight to Utah to see her boyfriend, Ryan Burns. She says, these masked intruders, they said they would kill my family. I just got in the car and drove to Utah to see Ryan. And I never said a word about it to anyone because I'm so terrified that they're going to come after me.
Yeah, bullshit. But yeah, no.
She's pretty sharp though.
That's a good one. That's good, but it's not. I mean, just like, I mean, that's a good one. That's a good story.
She's pretty sharp. So in September, she goes on Inside Edition, the TV show Inside Edition, and she tells them about these masked intruders that attacked her, and the media starts calling them the ninjas, that Jodi Arias was attacked by ninjas.
So they're making fun of her.
Oh, yeah. And she says, "No jury is going to convict me. I am innocent, and you can mark my words on that."
She sounds like a narcissist, like the textbook or the DSM-5 borderline personality definition of a narcissist.
I think she is. I think that is what they have said. They being probably people with the same amount of expertise that we have. But yeah, I think there's a lot of speculation that that's true.
I mean, that's an actual condition. It's not just somebody who likes to look in the mirror, you know?
Right.
And I know you know that, but I'm just saying it's a problem. These people are nuts, and whether or not they're dangerous is another issue altogether. So what happens with her now? Tell me, I'm dying to know.
This is the fall of 2008. Well, in the fall of 2010, I don't know why things take so long, but in the fall of 2010, Jodi changes her story about the killing.
Again?
And says she killed Travis and it was self-defense. He had this new digital camera. She was taking these pictures of him in the shower that he asked her to take because he wanted these hot, sexy pictures of himself. She dropped the camera. And, you know, there's the photo of it, you know, kind of taking a picture of the ceiling. She dropped the camera, sent him into a...
And he freaked out.
Yeah, sent him into a rage. He lunged at her. He was threatening violence against her. She ran to the closet, grabbed his gun, and shot him with his gun.
And then stabbed him in the back?
And then stabbed him 27 times and then slit his throat. I mean, there's so many problems with the self-defense story. One of the major ones being that forensic evidence does not support the shooting coming first.
Right.
All the forensic evidence shows that the shooting occurred after the stabbing. So, no. But anyway, that's her story now.
Ooh, man, that's tough. You know, and they can bring out the fact that you've said these other things have happened too.
Yep.
Like when somebody changes their story, like if a witness says A and then I know somebody who heard them say B, you know, and then they get on the stand and they say A, I can cross-examine them and say, well, you also said B, right? And they'll say, no, I only said A. And I'm like, okay, I can't talk to them anymore about it, but I can bring my witness who can say that they said B, that they said something different. And it's not to show whether or not the first thing they said was true or the second thing they said was true, but only to show that their credibility is suspect. And then, you know, you let it go. And a lot of times when I'm entering, this is a side note, but I just enter these things. I get them in. And then when the closing, I go crazy with it. Like I don't really touch it too hard in the trial because I don't want to ask a question that could be answered the wrong way. I just do whatever I can to get something like that in. Then I come back in my closing and I have fun with it. So, but anyway, with this, like, so all her stuff, you know, these statements, all these totally different statements, you don't even have to make the point of the argument that she's a liar. She's clearly lying.
Mm-hmm. I made up the intruders because I was just so ashamed that, you know, what happened between me and Travis had happened.
And here's the important, here's definitely the takeaway for that. And I've said it before. I said it like maybe in our first episode, like don't talk to, I mean, this is my opinion. Like don't talk to the police unless you have an attorney, even if you're innocent, because you could fuck things up. You might not, but you know, sometimes
it is true. Like if she came out of the gate with the self-defense story,
it would have been totally different.
She might have had a chance, but also, you know, then there's a part of me that says, well, she killed him. So I don't want her to come out of the gate with the self-defense story. I want her to say all this stupid shit because she did it and I want her to get caught.
Yeah.
She goes to trial. Testimony begins January of 2013. In the prosecution opening, you know, they obviously just talk about she's had all these different stories. You're gonna see that it's clear that she planned to kill him. And then the defense opening statement says he abused her. There was a lot of domestic violence. He became violent after she dropped the camera, and he, you know, lunged at her, and she remembers nothing about attacking him after the gunshot.
That's just
the prosecution. The case was tried by Juan Martinez, a star prosecutor in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. The prosecution presented their case in less than 2 weeks. And in addition to what we've already heard, 1 week before Travis's death, Jody Arias, remember she lived with her grandparents in Yreka, California? The grandparents had a robbery at their house and a 25 caliber handgun was stolen. Same caliber that shot Travis Alexander.
Interesting.
Now, obviously, you know, that's there's no forensic evidence there, but I hear all the time about 9mm and 22s. I never hear about a 25 caliber handgun. Like, that just seems unlikely.
That's what I was going to say. You're not talking about a popular gun. Literally, if they said that a 9mm got stolen, I'm like, what else would you expect to get stolen? I mean, there's tons of
exactly,
there, you know, but a 25mm is not very popular now. So that's a coincidence.
She also, she rented a car to drive down to Mesa. She didn't take her own car. She rented a car. She rented the car from a town that's about an hour south of the town that she lived in. So she went out of her way to rent the car somewhere that people would not recognize her. The car rental place offered her a red car, and she said she wanted something more discreet. She also filled her car with cans of gasoline so that she could drive the whole way without stopping for gas. And, you know, the prosecution's perspective on this is that she didn't want any trace of her being down in Arizona.
Yeah, that's pretty smart.
And when she returned the car, she had put about 2,500 miles on it.
She should have just taken her own fucking car. You know, I mean,
I guess she thought that friends or neighbors might recognize her car. She wanted something. She dyed her hair brown, like she was doing everything she could to not be noticed.
And that's the funny thing is, like, you've got to be like, you just have to be 100% clean in everything that you do, or everything becomes unraveled. So if you do 99 things correctly, but you do one thing wrong, you know, you're done. I mean, if I was committing crimes.
Yeah. Hot tip.
You know, just like if something like this happened to me, I'd get busted. Like if I was just somewhere and I wound up getting in a fight and whatever, I don't even know, just whatever. And I go from here to there and I'm like, let me try to remember everything. Like I'd forget something, my phone, you know, we're home and I'd be like, fuck, my phone's on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would have left my wallet. Like it's just,
or you carry your phone around the whole time and they can like see the pings and know where you went or whatever. Yeah.
But you have to be 100% correct. And she just slipped up a little bit with this.
With all of it.
How did it happen? Because there, you know, he's in the shower. Does she know she's getting ready to go up and kill him? Or did something happen? Maybe he did attack her and she was like, you know what? Fuck you. I'm done with this. But you can't do that. You can't cut somebody ear to ear because you're tired of them attacking you.
Right.
You know, you would have to go with that battered spouse syndrome or whatever. And that is it's been years since I've even really studied that, but I know that that is a very, very difficult hurdle to climb. And she's nowhere near that. She would be nowhere near being able to actually put forth some sort of affirmative defense for a battered person's syndromes. If she's the one who did this, there's no excuse for it. Like even if he was a jerk, you have to walk away when the situation's under control, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, anyway, you can't kill him. So.
But I mean, also just she put the camera in the washing machine. Why didn't she just bring it with her and throw it in the lake? Like, it's just so. Okay.
I was wondering that, too. Like, that doesn't make she should have just taken it with her.
No. So here's the other thing. She stripped the sheets. She stripped the sheets off the bed. I'm wondering if she threw the sheets in the washing machine and maybe accidentally dropped the camera in. Whatever happened, that was real dumb. And that did not solve the problem at all that she thought she was going to solve.
After deleting the photo, she probably thought she was a genius, deleted it and put it in the washing machine.
Okay, so prosecution takes 2 weeks to go through their case. The defense takes from January 29th to April 13th.
That is insane.
So Jody takes the stand. Jody takes the stand, first of all.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Like, so, did her attorneys know if she's getting ready to go up here and give her third story? Okay, continue. So she takes a stand. Oh my God.
They do. They know that she's a hot mess.
Oh God.
Actually, let me just interject this. One of her one of her attorneys is Kirk Nurmi. Let me make sure I got his name right. Kirk Nurmi. He was a public defender. He hated working with her so much that he resigned from the public defender's office in order to get off of this case. And the judge made him stay on the case. The judge denied his motion to withdraw, even after he resigned from the public defender and said he was the court-appointed attorney. He hated her.
Wow. I mean, she sounds like a terrible person.
Yeah. She testifies that she managed to wriggle free when he attacked her, ran to the closet to retrieve a gun that she knew he kept in there. She fired in self-defense and had no memory of stabbing him. She acknowledged trying to clean up the scene. She acknowledged dumping the gun in the desert, but not the camera. Camera went in the washing machine. And that she worked on an alibi to avoid suspicion. She said she was too scared and ashamed to tell the truth. But there was no evidence whatsoever that he had ever physically abused her, that he owned a gun. She also indicated that he had sexual desires for young boys. And there was never any evidence of that either.
She indicated that in the trial?
She did.
How? Like, how the fuck? I mean, because I would think that you can't do that. Like, first of all, there's no evidence. What relevance does that have toward any material fact in issue in the case?
His sexual abuse of her that led to her snapping came from, like, sexual deviance. I believe that's what she's trying to say.
I just am shocked that got in. Anyway,
she acknowledged lying repeatedly before and after her arrest, but insisted she was now telling the truth. This whole trial was aired in its entirety on TV. And there was so much detail about the sex that just captivated true crime people everywhere.
So this was 2008, right?
The trial's 2013.
Oh, okay. And the movie 50 Shades of Grey, I think, had come out. And the book would have come out sometime.
Yeah, right about then.
So people were all into crazy sex. I mean, they're always into it.
Crazy, kinky sex. And there was so much of that in this. They played phone sex that they had that she had recorded. They played in full and you can listen to it online. I mean, it's awful. It's awful that this guy has had all of this stuff become public after being killed. I just think it's so, they talk about victims' rights and everything. And I just find it so unfair that
I agree.
His life gets aired like this because she says that it was self-defense.
I agree. I mean, I think it's terrible, you know, because we're making it seem like it's something bad. This is a single guy just running around having some fun, I guess.
Just doing his thing.
And I mean, when I say single guy, I mean, she's a single girl, that's fine. I mean, get it on, you know, swing from the rafters and have fun.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's a shame. Cause now to me, it just seems embarrassing. It's nobody's business.
So embarrassing. And his family, you know, that believe so strongly that this kind of behavior was sinful, has to sit and listen to all of this. Yeah. And his family should just never know about this. This was his business. So it's just sad and awful. And I do get upset that this can happen. You think, well, as long as I never do anything bad in my life, then, you know, my private behavior is my private behavior. But no, somebody kills you, and then all of your private behavior becomes public. And I mean public, televised public. It's really sad.
Yeah, I've seen all sorts of funny memes. Like I saw one that was, hey, if I ever die unexpectedly, like I need my best friend to go find my phone and smash it. One was another guy. He was some kid on the, it was like he was about 30 years old. He's on the witness stand. And the question the prosecutor's asking him is, now we're going to go through your Friday night internet search history list. And he's leaning to the microphone. He's like, could I just confess to the murder, please?
It's really sad. It's really sad to watch the defense attorney stand up to give their opening arguments and start talking about how Travis abused her. And here's the thing. Maybe he did, right? Maybe he was physically violent with her, and that's why she killed him. It's still just sad to see the victim brought up in that way when there's no evidence of it other than her testimony. That's the only evidence of it at all. There's never been a call to the police. There's never been an injury that she suffered or anything like that. There was a bunch of psychology expert testimony that said all kinds of conflicting things. You know, the psychologist for the defense said she had post-traumatic stress disorder and dissociative amnesia, which is why she couldn't recall much from the day of the killing. Another defense psychotherapist said that Jodi Arias was a battered woman. And then a clinical psychologist for the prosecution said that those conclusions were invalid because of certain questions, the way that they were administered. And the prosecution's clinical psychologist expert said that Arias had borderline personality disorder, signs of immaturity, and an unstable sense of identity, and that people who suffer from such a disorder have a terrified feeling of being abandoned by others. This psychologist said, based on her evaluation of Jodi Arias, the defendant does not suffer from PTSD or amnesia and was not a victim of domestic abuse. So, you know, you just get into this thing where the jury just has to decide who they believe. And the jury's not an expert in this, you know, so.
Right. Battle of the experts. Yeah.
So, in essence, you had the prosecution saying, you know, she rented a car, packed it up with cans of gasoline so she didn't have to stop for gas and nobody would know she went to Arizona. She goes down. She kills Travis. She goes up to Utah to visit Ryan Burns. By the way, Ryan Burns testifies that when she got to his house, first of all, she's cool as a cucumber. He would never have known anything was wrong. Jury deliberates for 15 hours and they find her guilty.
Okay.
Of first degree premeditated murder.
Okay. She's looking at death.
I'm trying to remember. At one point, I was like, how can you call this premeditated? How can you be sure that it's premeditated? You know, because there's a high bar there to say that it was premeditated.
Well, I think it's the, you know, she stabbed him and then she went and got the gun. So somewhere in between stabbing him and then cutting his throat, there has to be a moment of quiet. There's a moment of reflection, even if it's while you're stabbing him and then you set it down, you get the gun and then you shoot him. You've thought about it at some point. Like there's a moment here where, you know, you've said, all right, I'm going to kill him.
I'll tell you, as somebody who is not a legal expert and somebody who would be more likely to sit on a jury than anything else, I don't buy that whole concept that you can premeditate murder in the moment. I know that legally they say you can, you know, that you had time to decide to then go shoot him. If it were me sitting on a jury, I would really need to know that she went over to that house with the intention of killing him to call it premeditated.
No, I agree. I agree with you, though.
Dyeing her hair, renting the car, bringing the cans of gas, those are things that all kind of lead me. And also the gun going missing, that's a 25 caliber, which is what he was shot with. Like, I do land on premeditated myself.
So you think she might have just gone over there? She was like, I'm gonna kill you, sucker. Like,
you know, that's a good question. I don't know what happened. Because if she went there to kill him, I'm like, why would she spend all day in bed taking these pictures? You know, I don't get it. I really don't get it. Why she didn't just go in and just kill him. I don't know.
Well, here's if she is an actual narcissist, they don't really have the ability to, they're sort of like, well, I don't want to confuse terms, so I'm not going to, but they don't have the ability to understand the feelings of other people. They know other people have feelings. They have feelings. They themselves can feel anger, sorrow, and joy. But they can't really feel what other people feel. So it seems like it would follow suit that she might've been able to be like, well, she's going to go over there. She is physically attracted to him. She's going to bang him a few times and then she's going to kill him.
God, how weird.
It is weird. It is really something.
It's really weird because I could totally get, all right, so she got the gun, she filled the car with gas cans and all this stuff to go down there and kill him because she was really angry. You know, she found out he was bringing Mimi Hall to Cancun and she felt like she was, that he was officially ending things for real. And she was, you know, whatever, something pushed her over the edge. But then going there and having this like day of fun before the killing and then the killing being so brutal, I could even see it if it was like she did the whole thing and then decided to shoot him and leave. But the brutality of that feels like a crime of passion. It feels in the moment, but it was obviously not in the moment. So I don't know. Logically, this one does not make sense to me. But I do. I land on first degree murder. Okay. So her sentencing needs to happen now. And the way that it works in Arizona is if the jury decides on a death sentence, then the judge is bound by that decision. If the jury decides against the death penalty, the judge has two options. He can sentence Jodi Arias to life in prison without the possibility of parole, or he can sentence her to life in prison with the possibility of parole after at least 25 years. Arias's attorneys once again ask to be allowed to step down from the case. They are so done with her.
Wow.
And once again, the judge says no. However, one of the legal experts who's reviewed this case, the details about the motion are sealed, but as soon as Jodi Arias was found guilty, she spoke to the press and she said, I believe death is the ultimate freedom and I'd rather have my freedom as soon as I can get it. So she's basically asking for the death penalty. And legal experts have said that her attorneys probably wanted to step down because it is their job to avoid the death penalty. And she's asking for the death penalty and that would just really complicate them defending her.
Wow.
The judge at this time said no one else could do an interview with Jodi Arias. She's just messing things up all over the place.
Dear God.
Yeah, legal experts say that the attorneys have a conflict of interest with their own efforts to try to save her life while she is saying she'd rather die. Just for the record, there are currently, or at this time, there were 127 people on death row in Arizona, and Jodi Arias would make the fourth woman to be on death row in the state. I don't think the fourth ever. I think the fourth at that time, that there were 127 people on death row, three of whom were women. Jodi would make four. Two juries deadlocked in the penalty phase of Jodi Arias's case. Juries could not agree that she should receive the death penalty. And so, like I said, after after the jury is unable to reach a decision twice, it goes to the judge, and he can either give her life without parole or life with parole. And the judge sentenced her to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Jodi Arias appealed her conviction and sentence, arguing that trial publicity, including the live media coverage of the proceedings and a prosecutor's alleged misconduct, that's the lead prosecutor, Juan Martinez, that this deprived her of a fair trial and an impartial jury.
Oh, Juan.
So a three-judge panel found that the prosecutor did engage in misconduct by being hostile and aggressive with each witness whose testimony was inconsistent with the state's theory of the case.
Huh.
However, Arias is not entitled to a new trial because evidence overwhelmingly showed she was guilty. The evidence, quote, would not have permitted any reasonable juror to acquit her of the charged offense. The evidence included uncontroverted evidence that Arias planned the killing, and that regarding the publicity, she failed to show that the juror's ability to impartially and fairly decide the case was adversely affected. So, yes, there was misconduct, but you don't get a new trial because it wouldn't have made a difference.
No. Yeah, that makes sense.
By the way, it took them 29 pages to say all that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Oh yeah, God. Judges. Okay. But
that makes sense.
In 2016, Kirk Nurmi, one of the two public defenders for Jodi Arias, self-published a book called Trapped with Ms. Arias.
Oh my God. No way. Oh, I love it.
The book included what the state bar described as disparaging remarks about the defendant and revealed details about private conversations that Nurmi had with Arias and members of her family. It also included evidence that had been deemed inadmissible by the trial judge. A bar complaint was filed against Nurmi, and he was disbarred for publishing the book.
Oh my God.
So I was telling somebody about this recently, and they said, you know, well, is it because she said this confidential stuff? And yes, you know, he violated attorney-client privilege because Jodi Arias did not agree to this book. I guess he could do it if she agreed to it, but she didn't.
Oh my God, he got disbarred for it. I better go buy it. What was it called?
Trapped with Ms. Arias.
Oh my God, I'm going to look that up. Trapped with Ms. Arias. I love it.
Like Nurmi, Juan Martinez published a book in 2016 called Conviction, The Untold Story of Putting Jodi Arias Behind Bars. His book also included unfavorable characterizations of Jodi Arias and alleged that one juror was in love with her. A bar complaint was filed against Martinez for his book, but Martinez's complaint was dismissed. But things don't end there for Juan Martinez. He also was disbarred.
Oh, no. Oh, it's for sale. Trapped with Ms. Arias. So tell me, oh my God, he got disbarred. That's terrible. Tell me.
Juan Martinez, there were all kinds of sexual harassment claims against him. And after a 30-year career as a prosecutor, he agreed to be disbarred in July of 2020.
As opposed to something much worse. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You don't just agree to be disbarred.
I guess you could. That's a good question. I was wondering when it says he agreed, like if he didn't agree, then maybe all of the details would come out. You know, if he kind of went on trial or something.
So,
since her trial, the prosecutor and the defense attorney have both been disbarred.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, it's terrible.
She's so toxic. And that's it. That is all I have for
Jodi Arias.
Jodi Arias, who is spending life behind bars.
You know, I mean, I have never been so in love with somebody that I wanted to kill anybody.
Can you imagine being asked to defend this piece of work with all her different stories? And oh, God.
Whatever. Yeah, sure.
I mean, you just go in there, you're like, yep, that's what we got.
What story are we going with today?
Oh, Kirk Nurmi, in his closing arguments, he said to the jury, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the quote, I am not asking you to like Jodi Arias. 9 days out of 10, I can't stand her.
Oh my God. You know, that's okay.
It's brilliant. Right? This isn't about whether you like her. She's horrible.
9 out of 10 days. I can't stand her. Oh my God. That's funny. That's so funny. Cause you said the name Jodi Arias. And I'm like, I know that name, but I knew zero about this case. That was fun.
Did you know anything
about that? No, that was cool.
Isn't it wild? Oh my gosh.
That was super fun. I'm going to go to murderpedia.org. Not just to look at pictures. I may not even look at them because you're not going to be able to resist.
And it's just,
I probably will. I've seen some crazy stuff. It's just awful. You know, so I'm going to have to do it now.
Yep.
Oh, that's fun. All right, cool. Well, hey, let's sign out.
All right. Well, before we go, we should just say thank you to everybody who's listening to us. We're having so much fun and we have almost reached, we're working towards our goal of 1,000 downloads. So anybody who listens to the show and likes it, I've had people ask me, you know, what can I do? And my answer is always just share it. Just share it. If you like it, just share it. Post it to Instagram, post it to Facebook, post it wherever you post things, telling people that you like it.
And leave a written review.
Yeah. And if you leave a written review on Apple, that would be amazing. And we have, for anyone who wants to support us regularly, we have a Patreon and we just have a $2 membership set up. So anybody who wants to give us $2 a month, that's like 50 cents per episode, patreon.com, patreon.com. That would be greatly appreciated. We are on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter at roomforinnocence.com with a number 4. I think that's it.
Yeah. Do it. Patreon. It's not even 10 cents a day.
Like cover everything?
I think you did.
All right. So let's finish this up.
Yeah. You did a great job. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris. And the defense rests.